Hi, my name's Noreen Jamil, and this is...
Emily Kate Stevens.
Both of us have been diagnosed with long COVID.
And we've created this podcast dedicated to the condition. Welcome to the Long COVID Sessions. Hi, Noreen. How was your week?
Not too bad. This week I've had some palpitations which I haven't had in about 6 months or more. Proper painful palpitations.
Yeah, are they the kind that stop you doing anything?
No, they don't stop me doing anything because now I just ignore them. I wonder if it's because I had a particularly bad menstrual session this month and whether it was lack of iron.
Yeah, blood loss.
Yeah.
Because anemia itself can cause palpitations, can't it?
Yes, it can. And I'm wondering if that's exacerbated it this month because I've been a bit lax in taking my iron tablets.
It's definitely something I would want to look at. There's actually a paper that came out this week looking at the long COVID manifestations due to problems with the red blood cells, the anemia and the elevated MCV. It's one of those things that the doctors have always dismissed in me, I think in you as well, as, oh, it's just anemia. And the anemia is directly related to blood loss. It's not ever been looked at more deeply in either of us than that, that perhaps the actual problem with the red blood cells is from the virus or is actually more of a symptom or cause of the long COVID than they're giving credit to.
I agree with that. And I think also, I mean, we have all this blood work and you and I have been consistently anemic for years now. And the other week, if you went to your GP, and because your range was just within the normal one part of it, you were considered okay.
There's all the various different markers, isn't there? There's the ferritin, the hemoglobin. About four or five of them were off, but one was almost within range, so I was fine.
Yeah, and the same with my T-cell count. My T-cell count's low enough for me to have a HIV test, but once they've decided I don't have HIV, it's fine. Must be a normal variation of low.
It's very frustrating, and it's also very frustrating that it's just marked against the arbitrary ranges that they came up with, who knows how. It's not actually considered on a chart versus where you were last month, last year.
No.
So how are you feeling now with the palpitations?
They were significant a couple of days ago, but they're okay now.
You think you're beginning to rebuild iron?
Maybe. I've stopped my period, so I'm not losing tons of blood.
Yeah.
And how are you feeling, Emily, this week?
You know, I had a pretty rough 6 weeks. I had 1 week where I didn't have headaches and, oh my God, it was so nice. It was so nice to feel okay. And then I got a massive migraine again yesterday and my stomach's now a bit destroyed and I've got the internal and external tremors at the moment. It still frustrates me that it really feels like there's no pattern. I did go to the gym to do yoga on Saturday, but that's no different to what I'd done the day previously or the day previously or the day previously. So I don't know what triggers things. But as you always say to me, the dips are less. That's true. The pain when I get a migraine, the pain when I'm actually in the dip is pretty horrendous. But more operational, they do last less time.
You were pretty depressed, though, when I spoke to you because this crash had gone on for quite some time.
What was it? In 6 weeks, I only had about 6 days that I didn't have a headache. It was pretty much a constant level of misery. It's not to say that I didn't have bright pockets within that, but it was just waking up every day with a headache again. I thought that I had made some progress and I really did feel like the first half of this year was better than the first half of the previous year. So then when you go for sort of 6-7 weeks of feeling like, no, this is still very much in my system and it's still very much prominent in my life, it's pretty depressing. But then I get a good week and I'm full of joy again.
It's the medical amnesia, I call it.
I'll take the highs. Your concern that what I do is going to damage me longer term because of the fact I keep exercising and things like that. I would honestly rather take the good days with the bad days than just feel like everything is mediocre.
To qualify that, I worry because the ME/CFS pattern, which is, if you look at our symptoms, we are all kind of ME/CFS patients. The more you don't take care of yourself when you're in the early stages of it, the more severe it can become later on.
Yeah, absolutely. I absolutely understand.
But again, I do understand trying to live your life as best you can as well.
Yeah.
Just have to find our own way, really.
Yeah. Now, this week, though, we did speak to someone who is trying to help both the long COVID and the ME/CFS community approaching things originally from ME/CFS and long Lyme. This is Dr. Amy Proar, and she's a microbiologist and president of the PolyBio Research Foundation,
which is doing so much work for long COVID and funding so many of the most exciting trials in the last 3 years.
Yeah, it's a non-profit research organisation, so it's all private funding. And so many of the people that have really stood out to us, I think, it turns out so many of them are part of the PolyBio long COVID group and are being funded by Amy Proal's organisation. So, Amy, tell me about your organization, PolyBio.
So, at PolyBio, we're a group of scientists. And what we do is we join together to better study conditions that we call infection-associated chronic conditions. And those are conditions that are initiated or exacerbated by infection, with ME/CFS being one, post-treatment Lyme disease or long Lyme disease being another one, and long COVID being a central and very widely recognized example of that at the moment.
This was an organization that you had prior to long COVID coming on the scene. So previously you were working in those other areas.
Exactly. So unfortunately, when the COVID pandemic began, our team actually knew in a way that patients, that a subset of patients who got infected with SARS-CoV-2 would very likely develop debilitating chronic symptoms. And that's because it's actually known, if you look at the literature and what we were studying before, that most major pathogens, most major viral pathogens, bacterial pathogens, and even fungal pathogens are actually associated with a chronic syndrome in which a subset of infected patients develop debilitating chronic symptoms and often do not recover and get seriously ill. So there's post-Ebola syndrome, there's post-Zika syndrome, there's post-Lyme disease syndrome, there's all these syndromes. And ME/CFS is a diagnosis that's given to patients who develop common symptoms, including flu-like and autonomic symptoms, after a range of different other infections, for example, enterovirus infection or herpes virus infection. So this overall trend of people not recovering after getting an infection was already what PolyBio was studying when the COVID pandemic began. And so at that time, even pretty early on, my colleague at PolyBio, Mike Benelziger, who also works at Harvard Medical School as a neuroscientist, we wrote a paper, I think fairly early on mechanisms that we thought could be contributing to long COVID. And they included the persistence of the virus, in other words, a failure to clear the virus from tissue, the possibility that SARS-CoV-2 infection could downregulate the immune system and allow other previously latent pathogens to reactivate and drive symptoms, that there could be microbiome issues in patients. And our ability to write that paper early on came from the fact that we were already studying those trends via our PolyBio projects in patients with conditions that started with other infections beyond SARS-CoV-2.
And how much understanding did you have before long COVID came on the scene into the actual mechanism that causes those post-viral conditions? So I know that ME/CFS comes from a range of different infections, but did you already have an understanding, or do you already have an understanding of the mechanism that drives it?
We had some idea of mechanism and certainly an understanding of the directions that we thought were most important to head to when we were creating long COVID studies. The first would be that one of the most important trends generally in the study of infection-associated chronic disease, a straightforward possibility for many patients is that they have chronic symptoms because they did not fully clear the pathogen from their bodies. In other words, a small amount of pathogen remains in what we're calling a tissue reservoir site, and it's not easily identified in patient blood, but it persists in tissue where it can continue to drive inflammation or even metabolic abnormalities, or continue to see spike protein issues, and that reservoir of virus could be what's driving chronic symptoms. There's definitely evidence for the persistence of pathogens as a driver of infection-associated chronic disease that comes from other related pathogens. So for example, post-Ebola syndrome is an interesting example where in the years before COVID started, there were teams that were studying patients who still had chronic symptoms after Ebola infection. And when they looked in their blood, they did not find signs of the Ebola virus there. But when they looked in patient tissue and eye tissue, sometimes even in breast milk samples, semen, sites outside of blood, they began to still find the genetic material of the virus. And they started to realize that people were harboring what they called Ebola RNA persistently in anatomical sanctuaries, a similar term to reservoir, right?
Viral debris.
No, not at all.
It was active replicating virus that was found in the case of Ebola.
Yeah. So that's the thing is at first, people weren't sure. When people say debris with RNA virus or other virus persistence, it's not the best term because when we find the virus in studies, we find the genetic material, we find the full backbone of the virus. So these Ebola teams were not finding parts of the virus, which is what the term debris sort of suggests. They were finding the entire backbone of the Ebola virus in these samples. Now, did that mean it was active? They weren't sure. RNA viruses can, in some senses, also have states of latency or inactivity, similar to the herpes viruses. So they didn't really understand the activity of the Ebola RNA. But then there was a very interesting situation where a new Ebola outbreak was sparked. And when they sequenced the strain of Ebola that started a new outbreak, it was almost identical to a strain of Ebola that a patient had had 5 years earlier. And about three separate high-level teams concluded that the new outbreak must have been started by a persistently infected Ebola patient who carried the actual Ebola virus in a persistent capacity and passed it to someone to even start a new outbreak. So that really began a lot of thinking on the front of, we have to take the persistence of viral genetic material and protein in these patients incredibly seriously. And that's what drew us into the topic of persistence in SARS-CoV-2 a lot. Also in ME/CFS, the history of ME/CFS, especially when the disease and the name myalgic encephalomyelitis was first coined in the 50s and 60s, was highly tied to persistent enterovirus infection. And enteroviruses are single-stranded RNA viruses that actually have a lot of similarities to SARS-CoV-2. They're also acquired via respiratory infection. Like SARS-CoV-2, they can also reach the gut in a certain number of patients. And there are actually really good studies, and this is one of the things we're truly working to build on at PolyBio, that have found persistent enterovirus genetic material and protein in the intestinal tissue samples of patients with ME/CFS diagnosis or in skeletal muscle samples. So there's a huge precedence for pathogen persistence in conditions like long COVID. And then there are other clues as well. For example, altered signaling of the vagus nerve is something that we were already looking at in ME/CFS patients and even in patients with chronic consequences from Lyme.
Let's hold on that because that is something that we would like to go into in some detail. But going back to your point there, and I was actually shocked when I read about this suggestion that there had been a reactivation of an Ebola epidemic from potentially a viral reservoir in someone. If we look at the comparison of long COVID and Ebola, have you seen evidence that that could happen with long COVID? Is there evidence to suggest that people with long COVID have a viral reservoir that could reinfect people?
It's a great question. And we actually don't have a firm answer to that right now. What we're finding is that part of what we're doing is collecting tissue samples from patients with long COVID. And that is a huge part of our PolyBio research program. The reason for that, and I'll just explain one more time, is that when pathogens persist in people over time, they rarely are found in the blood, because the blood is just a dumb place to be. That's where the immune system is really robust, and that's where they're most likely to get targeted and killed. So in simple terms, they hide in tissue, and that's where the immune system is less robust and where they can hopefully find a little niche there where they're not targeted as much. So we've been collecting tissue samples from patients with long COVID, and there are definitely teams. For example, we supported a pretty cool study at UCSF via Tim Henrich, Michael Peluso, Stephen Deeks, that team, where they did two things. They collected gut biopsy samples from 5 patients with long COVID, and then they also ran those same patients through a very high resolution form of imaging.
We actually spoke to Michael in our last episode.
Exactly. Yeah. So then he told you about the study, and they could still find spike RNA from the virus. They found that in all long COVID patients still had the virus in their tissue. In one patient, I think up to 676 days after initial infection, which was basically what the last time point they did the measurement, right? So overall, though, if a pathogen is in tissue, we don't know how often it can be passed to someone else. Because, for example, all these patients who have still viral genetic material or protein in their tissue samples, they test negative for the virus via the standard nasal swab testing, right? So they're no longer positive for the virus in the conventional sense of, oh, you tested positive for SARS-CoV-2. In fact, every study that has found SARS-CoV-2 RNA and protein in samples after acute COVID, the subjects have tested negative via that standard nasal swab testing. Even one study that found persistent SARS-CoV-2 genetic material and protein in the olfactory tissue of the nose, in the olfactory bulb, the same patient still tested negative for the virus in the fluid of the nose. So it's a very tissue-associated phenomenon when it comes to persistence. Overall, since we don't transmit tissue and we're not necessarily finding virus in fluid, and fluids are often passed between people, it's hard to say, right? But there is a team that's finding, you know, some teams still find that RNA is being shed in stool by people over time. For example, there was a Stanford study that showed that some patients after COVID still shed SARS-CoV-2 RNA stool for up to 210 days after initial infection. And I think another team's going to come out with some similar findings soon. So if people are still shedding over time, in some cases, and again, could vary by case, viral RNA in something like stool, then maybe there's some potential for transmission.
Going back to your comment on Ebola, that it was found in semen, are we potentially looking at what we have with HIV? A lot of researchers that we speak to draw a lot of comparisons. Obviously, the team at UCSF draw a lot of comparisons through their work with HIV. But is there a thought that we could be looking at that potential reinfection via bodily fluids?
There have been one or two teams that looked for SARS-CoV-2 in semen and didn't find it. Okay. We should probably keep checking. I actually just think in terms of precaution, we should probably really do more studies like in Ebola of semen. I don't see why not, but I don't think that there have been as many early signs in some of the studies for semen and SARS-CoV-2 generally. I think, though, that the reason that we're focusing strongly with our research program, and we have a lot of themes running with our studies, it's not just persistence, but the reason we're focusing on persistence as the major topic of investigation is because of considerations like these. These are major considerations in which the topic of SARS-CoV-2 persistence isn't even relevant to just long COVID. It's actually relevant to the whole pandemic. It's actually just relevant to how the virus continues to spread and how we continue to see this situation where we're dealing with COVID evolve over time. Because actually, there have been studies that have found SARS-CoV-2 protein and genetic material in samples from people without symptoms, which is interesting. I've had some people say, oh, well, that's good then. If people with symptoms and without symptoms and with long COVID symptoms could still have viral RNA and protein in a sample weeks or months after COVID, then maybe it doesn't matter that much. And I totally disagree. I actually think it's way more concerning because, for example, there was this team at NIH and the study that they did was they got lymph node, adenoid and tonsil tissue that contains lymph node tissue from children who were undergoing routine surgery just to get their tonsils removed. The reasons why the kids were getting their tonsils removed are not fully clear. In some cases, tonsils are removed because of respiratory issues, so there might have been some propensity in those kids to have problems with SARS-CoV-2, but they were asymptomatic, essentially, and not deemed long COVID children. They were just undergoing these routine surgeries. And when the team at NIH looked, they found SARS-CoV-2 RNA, the genetic material, in the majority of the lymph node samples from those children undergoing routine surgery. And they found the immune responses, the B cell responses, to be very skewed in those children. We don't really know to what extent people are hanging on to this virus, or at least the genetic material of the virus, who may not even have symptoms now, but down the road could develop symptoms. And that is extremely disconcerting because persistent viral activity, for example, the herpes viruses and even other RNA viruses are being connected to Alzheimer's disease, are being connected to multiple sclerosis. There's a huge wave in which persistence of viruses is the hot topic on those fronts. So if we are seeding people with SARS-CoV-2, whether or not they develop long COVID symptoms or not, it is a problem that needs to be studied over the long term for a number of reasons.
Would you be looking at doing a study where you just examine a lot of people that don't have any long COVID symptoms to see statistically it's the majority of people who have persistent RNA in their system?
Yes, exactly. So that is one of the areas of research we're working on. We recently wrote as a group a position paper that was published in Nature Immunology a few weeks ago on SARS-CoV-2 persistence in long COVID,
which we will link to on our website for those that want to read it.
Awesome. And you can see in that paper, we delineate major areas of investigation moving forward. And those are actually what we're working on, and we shared them with the rest of the field as well. And one really is to understand the extent to which people without symptoms harbor SARS-CoV-2 genetic material and protein in comparison to those that have long COVID symptoms. Part of how we'll understand that is in all of our studies, there's a control arm. So in all of our studies, we have patients with long COVID symptoms, but also people who are either healthy or have gotten COVID and recovered. So we're collecting the same samples and doing the same forms of analysis on those control participants, and we can start to see if any of them harbor RNA or protein as the controls, even though they're not symptomatic. And in some studies, you can already see signs of that happening, which is, again, somewhat disconcerting. For example, there's a couple studies now that have identified spike protein in the blood of patients with long COVID or other SARS-CoV-2 protein. And what we think is happening there is we think that the virus that's persisting in patients' tissue, for example, the lining of the gut or in the lung or in some other tissue body site, but then the spike protein can shed, in simple terms, off the virus, likely in an exosome, it's a little vesicle, and then get into the blood, the protein, not the virus, the protein it's making is kind of shedding into blood. Then we can measure that protein, and that measurement of spike protein in blood is actually likely to be one of the more useful long COVID biomarkers. There's a growing number of teams that are finding spike protein in long COVID blood. And when that is measured in some of the studies that have done this, it depends on the study, up to 60% to 30% of long COVID patients have protein in blood. And there's a number of variables that could contribute. The thing is, it's only a proxy of viral persistence, because someone who could, let's say, still harbors persistent SARS-CoV-2 in their brain, it's very possible that the spike protein doesn't get into the blood. It's just not in a site where it's going to leak into blood. So it's a proxy, but still overall, the controls in some of those studies, the people who are the healthy comparison people have spike protein sometimes or other proteins in their blood too. Not as many as the long COVID patients, but some of them still have it.
That was going to be my question. Is it that we are all harboring the virus in our tissues universally, those of us that have got it, but there's something different in the long COVID patients about that spike protein releasing into the blood? Is there evidence of what is different in the long COVID patients versus the controls or versus the people who at the moment don't have long COVID?
Exactly. And it's an open question that we're trying to study, but it's the right question, because it may be that a significant number of people hang on to SARS-CoV-2 RNA and thus still have circulating spike protein to an extent after COVID. And some people develop symptoms and some people don't. And maybe certain people who have the spike, let's say in blood, develop symptoms because there are other factors at play. So for example, maybe in addition to having the SARS-CoV-2 reservoir and the spike protein leakage into blood, they also have problems with their gut microbiome. And that means that there's leakage because of a leaky gut, for example, of bacterial organisms that also seed inflammation into the blood. And maybe the inflammation from that microbial translocation or something augments an inflammation in a way that makes that person more susceptible to inflammation from the spike protein or something. You see what I'm saying? There might be certain factors in the long COVID patients that increase the way that the immune system responds to spike or to persistent virus in a way that drives more symptoms in that individual. And that is exact part of what we're studying. That's why our studies on persistence, a lot of them do incorporate microbiome analysis into the same study, or analysis of the immune response into the same study, or even analysis of human gene variants that can set people up differently on the human gene side in terms of how their immune systems respond to infection or other processes that can be downstream, for example, clotting or other issues.
So personally, is this your favorite hypothesis for the driver of long COVID?
Yeah, it is, for a number of reasons. Overall, as I mentioned before, persistent infection is the most studied and where the most concrete findings have often been noted in other infection-associated chronic conditions. So you have precedents for this. For example, the post-Ebola syndrome or the enterovirus research in ME/CFS. Also, one of the things about long COVID cases that we noted early on, as you guys would know, is that there are people who are asymptomatic when they get COVID, or they have very few symptoms, and then they start to get sicker over time. They actually get worse as weeks go on, and then they become more sick. And often those patients go through periods where they feel a little bit better and then they crash, or they feel a bit better and then they crash. You have these fluctuating symptoms. All of that, again, this is just thinking, but logical thinking, is very suggestive of viral persistence. Because if let's say the effects of long COVID, which could be in some patients, we know patients who have bad cases of COVID are hospitalized, would be, let's say, driven by unresolved inflammation from the acute infection. That could happen, but if someone had an asymptomatic case, that doesn't really make sense. And so it seems like something is, if the person is getting worse and their symptoms are evolving over time, it makes sense that something is still there that's causing that evolution of symptoms. The relapsing kind of crashing symptoms also suggest that there could be periods where maybe virus in a reservoir site is inactive for periods, but then maybe goes through periods depending on other factors impacting the immune system where it begins to create protein again, and that could cause more symptoms. And so when you kind of see that fluctuating nature of symptoms, it actually makes a lot of sense.
And do you think that then that viral persistence, because the other theories such as the reactivation of herpes or EBV, the autoimmunity, do you think that the viral reservoir is then the sort of upstream effect that then leads to those things, rather than them necessarily all being completely separate drivers as is being looked at?
Exactly. You just hit the nail on the head. In our paper, we actually delineate how there's a table there, how SARS-CoV-2 reservoir can actually contribute to most of the other findings already noted in long COVID.
Microclotting is the
other. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Let's say spike does leak into blood from a tissue reservoir site. Well, Ricia Pretorius and team have actually done an experiment where they took platelet poor plasma from healthy people, but they added the SARS-CoV-2-S1 protein and then fibrinogen, very similar to what's in the microclots formed, right? So there's this direct ability, it seems, of spike to seed fibrin deposition that could be connected to the microclots, right? So you can explain a lot of the sequelae, if you will, from that. And let's say then someone, microclots are at least in part seeded by spike protein, and now someone has the activated microclots. We also find in a number of studies hyperactivated platelets in the same patients. Well, platelets have receptors that recognize a wide range of bacterial proteins, so they'll also respond to spike protein. That could be part of the reason that they remain in an activated state. Now, once you have that clotting and the inflammation there from the platelet activation, you can have problems where the inflammation can start to impact the blood vessels. You might even have a loss of blood flow due to the little microclots to the small peripheral nerves of the body. Those nerves are really energetically demanding. They need a lot of blood and oxygen. So if the microclots start to kind of accumulate in the capillaries, the little blood vessels that feed that nerve, you might have those nerves die off or diminish. That can
cause small
fiber neuropathy. Yeah. So you can actually begin to connect a lot of trends in the field. Vagus nerve being another one that I could go into.
I would like you to talk about the vagus nerve, because it's something that has occurred in various of our conversations, but I don't really feel that we've had a sufficient explanation of quite the role of the vagal nerve and the way that it comes out in our symptoms. And I've heard you talking about it before. So would you be able to explain the way that that vagal nerve, the sickness response and the inflammation signaling and the things that the vagal nerve actually does and how it's impacted in long COVID?
Definitely. So the vagus nerve is a very important nerve that innervates every major trunk organ of our bodies and then connects to the brain at an area called the brainstem, which is in the back of the brain, the dorsal brainstem. And it regulates a lot of communication between inflammatory signals in the body and relays them to the brain so that the brain can respond accordingly and tell the body what to do in simple terms. Now, we've always been interested in this vagus nerve to brainstem signaling in especially, for example, ME/CFS, people who get that diagnosis, because the brainstem, the area in the back of the brain where the vagus nerve connects at that spot, has these overlapping nerve bodies that control symptoms that are very common in patients with ME/CFS or long COVID. So there's an area called the nucleus of the solitary tract in this brainstem. And that area controls what is called the sickness behavior response. And what that means is that, let's say someone gets an infection or some kind of inflammatory insult in their body, the brain needs to know that this is happening to alert the person to say, you're sick, you need to lay down, you need to rest, you need to, in a sense, respond in a sickness manner to the fact that you have an infection or an issue. If there's inflammation in the body, the vagus nerve will sense that, and then it will convey this pro-inflammatory signal to that area of the brain to activate the sickness behavior response that basically initiates flu-like symptoms in a patient. Now, if you have, let's say, reservoir of SARS-CoV-2, let's say you didn't fully clear the virus from your gut, that inflammation, low-level inflammation from the persistence of the virus might activate that vagus nerve signaling that goes to the brainstem and signals that sickness behavior response to begin. And if you don't clear the infection, you will just get the perpetual stimulation of these flu-like and malaise symptoms that are obviously extremely common in patients. And the interesting part is that that same area of the brainstem that controls the sickness behavior response also has basically overlapping a nerve body that controls autonomic function. So the ability to move from a sitting to a standing position, to regulate blood pressure flow, that controls autonomic function, and another nerve body that controls nausea and pain signaling. So you have these hubs just sitting on top of each other of what are almost core symptoms of long COVID in one place. And so if vagus nerve is stimulated, all the signaling of all those nerve bodies might be thrown off. And then you would essentially develop flu-like malaise, autonomic nausea and pain symptoms, which is what we see in many long COVID patients. So vagus nerve to brainstem signaling is a unifying way for patients who have different infectious or inflammatory issues to develop common sets of symptoms in long COVID cases. So example, I said reservoir. Someone might have a reservoir of the virus in the gut, and that's stimulating the vagus nerve to continue to throw those nerve bodies off to drive the flu-like autonomic symptoms. But someone else might have reservoir in the lung or another body site also innervated by the vagus nerve, and similar signaling could occur, and they could also get similar autonomic pain, nausea symptoms, right? So it helps explain why people who have reservoir or even just other forms of inflammation or even inflammation driven by the reactivation of other pathogens, let's say herpes viruses or something, there could still be a pathway by which that inflammation converges on signaling that leads to these common symptoms.
I think it's such a good way to think about the possibility of why we all have these very different symptoms. There's been a lot of conversation about that. Is it because of where the virus is residing, or is it your vagal nerve signaling?
Yeah, so what I get from this is the first time that it's been made clear to me, because we always talk about vagus nerve injury.
Yeah.
And this is not really an injury, is it? It's more of an overreaction. So you've got the screaming lady in the corner going, oh my God, we've got something going on. But it's not an actual injury to the vagus nerve.
No, it's not injury in what I just described. And I'm not saying vagus could be injured. Who knows? Maybe it could be, right?
Because up until now, we've always felt that how people talk about the vagus nerve in terms of long COVID is that it's been injured somehow.
We were saying it's basically being modulated, but in a sense, what it would be doing in the model I just described is the problem is a failure to clear the reservoir. The vagus nerve is actually doing its job, saying, look, there's still something here. You're still sick. There's still an infection here. And it's continuing to signal that circuitry that doesn't resolve because you haven't cleared that underlying issue, right? So it's actually doing its job, although over time, it becomes almost counterproductive, because if you're not addressing the reservoir, the site source of the inflammation, you're generating symptoms, and there's whatever, you could say that that's not really helpful, but it technically is doing its job.
If we therefore try to control things with things from the brain down. So if it's CBT or mindfulness or the lightning process, some people have had results with, can you control the vagal nerve going that way? And in doing so, are you then actually turning off what might be essential signaling?
Yeah, I mean, to me, the lightning process is complete bullshit. It's a cult. I absolutely just can't stand anyone there. And I warn everyone to not even go close to those people. I'm not joking. It's a true cult. And I don't believe a single thing about recovery there. They're just pressuring people in a cult mentality to say they're getting better. I've had friends do this, and it's actually really concerning. I'm not saying that there can't be other techniques so that are more realistic that could impact vagus nerve signaling. That's certainly whatever it is, meditation, other kinds of actually normal mindfulness techniques. Sure, it makes sense to me that trying to do whatever possible to just get cognitive signaling, which will involve vagus nerve in better shape, wouldn't hurt anyone with this issue. Of course,
you're saying it's a physiological response, right?
Definitely. One of the things we're really interested in is in that the vagus nerve wouldn't be damaged, but could be, I mean, it could be, but directly infected, which would be actually one of the more straightforward ways that you could develop a classic, I will say, long COVID case of flu-like autonomic and other known symptoms. Because there's an autopsy study recently, and it was a study of patients who did die during acute COVID, but they did get, and they're good for them because it's hard to get that tissue. They got vagus nerve tissue from most of the patients in the study, and they found SARS-CoV-2 RNA in the majority of those vagus nerve samples from patients who died from acute COVID. So the virus is obviously capable of getting into the vagus nerve, which, to be honest, the idea that SARS-CoV-2 would infect all these body sites and all these places, but just leave the vagus nerve alone, leave this almost super highway of communication alone and not infected, is actually very unlikely. So we're very interested in the possibility that in some patients, at least, the nerve might even be directly infected. And that's a just straightforward, very simple explanation for chronic symptoms. In ME/CFS, my colleague Mike Van Azoker wrote a paper, I think in 2009 or 2011, already hypothesizing that in patients with ME/CFS, the vagus nerve might be infected by herpes viruses or other pathogens.
Really?
Yep. We've been thinking this and trying to do it for a long time.
In terms of the millions of people waiting for some kind of actual medical help, if we feel strongly enough that the viral persistence is the main driver, what are the studies, or what favorite studies do you have looking at ways to treat it? Given that we've seen it in Ebola, we've seen it in ME/CFS, that we know there's a history of viral persistence, but we still don't have any good ways to deal with it. There are no antivirals out there that could help us.
There might be, though. The key, and Michael Peluso is a good person to talk about this with, is we are beginning to support and help to conceptualize clinical trials on SARS-CoV-2 reservoir. You actually hear us announce some of that moving forward in the coming months. And what is going to be necessary, and this is where looking at the HIV world really is going to be very helpful and involving teams like Peluso and Deeks and other researchers, John Wary, who we work with, who come from the HIV world, is incredibly important, because what they understand there is that it takes combinations of therapeutics to clear persistent
That's
virus.
That's exactly what Michael said last week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But in terms of HIV, they don't clear it. They
manage it.
Reduce it.
And there are currently no antivirals that can sort out EBV or herpes viruses in general. We don't have them, do we? We don't have anything that clears viral reservoir of herpes viruses.
I mean, just the whole pharmaceutical industry, there are not very many antivirals available. Even when you get influenza A or influenza B, no one is handing out. You just have to deal with it on your own.
I agree. And this is part of why we started PolyBio. This is part of why we brought together truly some of the top teams in the world to study the persistence of SARS-CoV-2 and related viruses, is because we need to create heavy hitting papers with excellent methods that show that patients with these conditions continue to harbor virus to motivate the pharmaceutical industry to make more antivirals. Because you're right, unless we demonstrate how big the problem is, we're not going to have the buy-in to continue to create therapeutics as otherwise would happen. And I think what's important too is that we collaborate with teams studying persistent viral activity and related diagnoses. For example, in MS, the MS disease process was recently connected to Epstein-Barr virus in two really good studies, including one that showed that the autoimmunity in MS may actually be a result of the immune response firing on an Epstein-Barr virus protein. And then that protein is similar in size and shape to a human neuron protein, and it sort of hits that protein as collateral damage. But the virus is the initial reason that the immune system fired, right? So in MS, there is now more push for development of herpes virus antivirals, and not even just antivirals, immunotherapies are also going to be really important. In other words, we're going to need to try to target the virus itself, but also to help the immune system. For example, to help energize the T cells of patients to come back and target the pathogens themselves or other parts of the immune system. For example, interferons are part of the immune response that targets pathogens, and we might be able to create therapeutics that up the activity of interferons so that the immune system itself is actually also helping to go after, if you will, the pathogen. That's what's innovated cancer treatment recently, where you have treatment in cancer now where they'll actually take the person's T cells and engineer them to go after components of the tumor that the specific cancer patient has. It's called T-cell immunotherapy. And it's not impossible that we could create immunotherapies where we energize T cells to better go after the SARS-CoV-2 virus in a persistent state. Even monoclonal antibodies are another tool we're thinking about. When you talk to Michael, we partially supported that study via ARIEM at UCSF. We're actually adding a pretty big experimental medicine component to that study where we're going to test a lot of parameters of persistence before and after people get the monoclonal antibody in the trial. But that's another example of seeing if you can get the immune system to provoke, if you will, the pathogen in the reservoir to get it into a state where it's a little less comfortable, with the knowledge that, as with HIV, they'll probably have to add in an antiviral or even a second one along with that so that you're provoking the virus out of the reservoir site via the immune system and then hitting it with antivirals, even sometimes with different mechanisms of action. So it's definitely a challenge, but there is precedent for combination therapy and there are a lot of talented people that can work on this. So I'm optimistic in a way, but...
Do you think we have more power with the elements that you have in PolyBio, which is bringing in the ME/CFS community, the Lyme community? Do we have more power to push the pharmaceutical companies if we all club together like that? Because there's talk in this country of disbanding long COVID clinics because people with other illnesses are upset that money's being spent on long COVID and not on them. This is what I heard from the long COVID clinic. Mm-hmm. Do you think it's better to keep it separate, or should we be putting all of these post-viral conditions in together?
That's a good question. I think that it's important, because I have been a little confused myself sometimes. It's important to keep long COVID as a distinct condition, even though there are overlaps with the symptoms that patients with ME/CFS experience, and there could be overlaps in mechanism. SARS-CoV-2 is a novel virus that has proteins that do very specific things and infects specific tissue in a very specific way. So it's important that if someone's case of chronic symptoms began with SARS-CoV-2, that they are a long COVID patient. And I consider that a distinct condition. Now, they might meet ME/CFS diagnostic criteria. That's helpful to know in a symptom way, but it doesn't really add all that much more to the knowledge of the case. It's helpful, but especially if we're looking at persistence as a key topic, it matters that the SARS-CoV-2 element of the case matters greatly, right? Because we will have to do, as we're saying, these combination clinical trials. And even when we're trying to get pharmaceutical companies to come in and trial their drugs, already the definition of long COVID is very broad for them. Certainly not everyone with a long COVID diagnosis necessarily has persistence. They could have had a very bad case of COVID and their lungs are damaged. There's a lot of people that fall. I think persistence is the most central unifying trend likely, but that's still a pretty heterogeneous group of patients within the long COVID name alone, right? So if you're trying to get pharma to come in, if anything, you're already just starting with long COVID only, and then you're trying to narrow long COVID even into a smaller group of patients that might have the most consistent results in a trial. So for example, there are some antiviral trials where having spike protein in blood is part of the inclusion in the trial in the first place, right? So we can narrow down the group of people who might respond most to that antiviral. So in that sense, bringing ME/CFS into that particular trial or something doesn't make too much sense. Now, There are times, though, when it does make sense to bring in MECFS cases or even people suffering from chronic Lyme issues. And that's what we do at PolyBio. Once we have put in and worked very hard to develop the infrastructure to get a huge study off the ground, let's say getting intestinal tissue from patients with long COVID, we can then take that infrastructure and to a point, move it into an MECFS study where we can get tissue from the MECFS patient. But we do have to change the methods. We're looking for different viruses. There's differences in it. It still means, though, that I think that teams studying long COVID should have MECFS on their radar. It makes sense. But I think long COVID being its own condition, it is important. And that being said, I just started to work as the research director for a new clinic at Sinai with David Petrino and team.
Oh, wow.
And we are including patients with long COVID and the MECFS diagnosis and long Lyme disease at the clinic. And the reason being that, especially when it comes to the treatment and overall clinical picture of patients, there's enough overlap that it makes sense to have those patients together in one space, right? Because sometimes yes. you'll actually find that a person with an MECFS diagnosis tests positive for the Lyme pathogen, and then we can actually maybe do more treatment tied to that organism, and then they're at the clinic. So
also validating for these patients as yeah, well to be included, because exactly. for so long they, yeah. you know, their voices haven't been heard. Any of these chronic diseases.
Exactly. Exactly. So I think that overall, sometimes studying and treating patients with long COVID, MECFS, long Lyme together makes sense, and there's ways to do it. And then in some cases, though, let's say a specific SARS-CoV-2 clinical trial or, you know, antiviral trial or a SARS-CoV-2 monoclonal, you do want to make sure that you have a very distinct long COVID patient population for certain things like those trials or other certain studies.
Can I just take you back one question? This T-cell immunotherapy.
Yeah.
Now, in people with long COVID, it's been shown that a lot of their T-cells have been exhausted, I think is the phrase. Is there a way to help? Is it an infusion or is there a way to make these T-cells recover in order to be able to fight the persistent virus?
Not at the moment. That right. is something we're hoping to develop. So there are one or two labs who are thinking along the lines of, we could do this in cancer. What if we do something similar for the T cells that might still be, you know, exhausted via either from SARS-CoV-2 persistence? T cell exhaustion can be very related to persistence. It doesn't have to be, but one of the reasons yeah. T cells become exhausted is if they don't fully clear the virus.
Still fighting.
It keeps, it's the same thing. They keep saying it's there, and they're activated as they do that. So they're in a way activated more, and yet they begin to express these markers of exhaustion because they're tired from the continual signaling of that activity. So I think key in that, again, is our core mission at PolyBio is we're going to need to pull talent in from related conditions to best study and treat long COVID. And that includes engaging the HIV community in the design of clinical trials and in the studies of persistence where they already, you know, that Pelusa team at UCSF already can collect gut biopsies and lymph biopsies. And they have all of that set up because that was important for understanding HIV. So we come in and help them iterate that infrastructure into long COVID. So taking the same thing, now we can talk to people working on cancer immunotherapy, working on related treatments, maybe in MS. There's people trying to work on immunotherapy there and say, hey, once you've done it for X condition or this, what do you think? What about SARS-CoV-2? And that's a big reason why our program has several pillars, which is the research and the research being really comprehensive to create this knowledge base that can really show these players, the people in other fields, the people developing other treatments, can really show them the need for whether it's immunotherapies or even sometimes other technology to be brought into the long COVID space. So as we do the research, we're moving into clinical trials, but research and continuing to show the root cause drivers of long COVID, including persistence over time, are really key to being able to create these materials that people in related fields can reference to say, yeah, I get it. And I want to come into that space.
It's really exciting. You're working with literally the leading players in this space. You know, Harvard, UCSF, a lot of people that to whom we've already spoken, Stephen, who was mentioned, whether you like Kiko, Harlan Krumholtz, all of these people. I think last year I read that you had raised $15 million and your aim was to get to $100 million for furthering this research. Where are you at this point?
We are likely to be announcing new additions to our program soon.
Right.
But we've gotten, well over $15 million in funding, but primarily from Vitalik Buterin, who is an incredible funder in the long-COVID space.
But working with that sort of weight of scientists, does that then bring money in from their organizations as well to help you with it, or they get independent funding?
Well, the way that we work is one of the big problems that we face right now is that the NIH is not funding long COVID research very much. There's not even a very reliable long COVID funding mechanism.
But what about all the recovery money? None of that's coming to you guys? None at all.
No, Steve and that site are a recover site, but it covers a limited amount of what they're doing. So we put private funding into a good amount of what's happening at that site to really make it work. I think Akiko has one small study that's part of it. Other than that, no one that I can think of in our consortium is funded via RECOVER or part of it at all. But no, the whole point is RECOVER is a very select group of people at certain institutions only that only represents a handful of the teams that are actually studying long COVID. And so the problem became that the US government said, oh, we have it covered with RECOVER, but then all these teams, like the ones in our group, weren't part of it and didn't have another way to get funding. So what we did is we raised private money to give them the money to do the work. And now we are highly encouraging NIH to just create NIH grants for long COVID that anyone can apply to. Any team can. RECOVER is just a select group.
Wow. I know that there have been issues with it, but I didn't realize that really none of these people who are at the front of the research field are receiving that money.
I was actually just going to draw you right back to the beginning of the interview where you hinted at the worry that we're looking at most of the world has had COVID, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone's kind of been infected. There are very few people who can put their hand up and say, yet to have COVID. And if viral persistence is shown in almost everybody, the potential for a time bomb disease down the road, a Alzheimer's, a cancer, a you name it, it could be MS. Why are people not taking this more seriously? And how worried are you that this is going to happen?
Extremely worried. It's definitely something I contend with every day. It's not a sustainable situation. So people are getting infected with SARS-CoV-2, which can drive a lot of problems. It may not clear from the patient, may persist in the person. And people are getting COVID sometimes up to 3 to 4 times a year. They're getting infected with different variations of this same virus. It's already hard enough to think about clinical trials that might address one variant of the virus, because sometimes, for example, the immunotherapies might have to be, let's say, Delta or Alpha wave specific, and we're seeding people with variants that we can barely keep track of potentially. That's completely crazy. We're seeding children, for example, in that tonsil study with persistent virus when they're young and they have years and years and years ahead of them where there's no end in sight for this pandemic or the fact that they will not get infected with this virus again and again and again and again. And every time that people get infected, it does seem that there's evidence that the immune system can suffer. There can be, like, you're experiencing T cell exhaustion and other issues, give or take, depends on the person. But as this builds up, it's hard to see too many people really escape not having some kind of problem by their, I don't know, 20th COVID infection. I don't even know what people think would happen. And overall, like I said, with Alzheimer's disease being connected to viral activity, for example, and I mean straight connected, there's a team at Harvard that we work with. They're authors on our paper of SARS-CoV-2 persistence. And there's actually a full paragraph and section in the paper on this. The plaque in the Alzheimer's brain, the so-called plaque, is now actually being studied by their team as part of the immune system that forms in response to persistent viruses in brain tissue. In other words, the persistent viruses are seeding Alzheimer's plaque. And Alzheimer's incidence has gone up since COVID. It was already a huge problem. Viruses drive cancers. The capacity for this to just drive an increasing wave of human chronic disease generally is huge. I think that one of the things that we are really working on this year is that I've gotten to know a number of the researchers who are working on technologies to clean the air, this was actually part of Vitalik and team introducing us. And one thing that I think we're going to continue to, in a sense, message along with long COVID is that one of the things we can truly do today in public spaces is to use existing technologies. There are really excellent HEPA filters. There are germicidal UV systems that can clean virus from the air. There are truly realistic ways that if you just put in the infrastructure and time right now, you can create a room, for example, a school classroom or a bus station or a public building in which the SARS-CoV-2 in the air is greatly, greatly decreased. And I think that the advancement of that technology and the need to clean the air in public spaces should go hand in hand with the advancement of long COVID technology and the study that we're doing, along with other strategies. We simply cannot just be expected to clean up the mess of a system that is doing nothing, not even using basic technology to clean air. When you have water, when you go to drink water from your tap, at least here in the US, it's purified to a point because people took the effort to say, we think clean water matters. We would like to drink clean water. So why would you not say that of your air now? Why would you not want clean air in your homes, in your schools? These are basic things that we can do. So part of what we're doing is we are increasingly talking to the air quality scientists, and we're working together even with them to push forward at least an understanding of a revolution in clean air being associated with what we do with long COVID. That's not even a full answer. It's just one of the things that we're trying to do.
Well, it's also one of the things that seems a bit expensive when you could just say, if you test for COVID, if you have COVID, please stay home.
That too. And in addition to those very obvious, straightforward possibilities. But the thing with clean air is we put so much money into wars, into building nuclear submarines. We could obviously invest money in better air quality infrastructure if it just became a priority. And I'm not sure who this is hurting. In addition to clearing SARS-CoV-2 from the air, it would be better for mold. It would be better for fires and smoke, which are issues. It would be better for just other pesticides and chemicals that get into people's air. It's hard to really see the negative in upping our infrastructure along those lines.
You say that the economic impact in the US alone of long COVID is what, $743 billion a year at the moment. Whereas if you invested a fraction of that into preventative methods.
And last but not least, it's really important that we innovate treatment of acute COVID to prevent long COVID. So that's another area where, for example, we're going to need to know, and people have been studying this. There's just an article that came out yesterday where there's growing data showing that people who get Paxlovid during acute COVID are less likely to develop long COVID. That makes sense, especially if it's viral persistence. Maybe the antiviral mitigated that a bit when you got COVID. So again, the kind of treatment that people can receive, maybe there would be more innovation of combination therapies that people can begin when they get COVID to even prevent them from developing long COVID and from virus getting into more sites in their body. So it's another area we have to think about more where this vaccine-only strategy has not been okay. That can be part of a picture, but we also need to be much more aggressive on what we actually offer people when they get COVID too.
Do you not hold out hope for a vaccine that actually prevents you from getting COVID?
I hold out hope. It's not my area of expertise, but I hold out hope for it.
Because that would be the way. But again, I mean, you're looking at Western world only, the rest of the world without any of these facilities, Ebola style spread.
That's another thing that we're really big on at PolyBio is to the extent that we fund any research, we fund open research. If we fund projects, people have to publish open access in journals where everyone in the world can read it. They cannot publish behind a paywall. They have to share their findings with other teams to the greatest extent possible. We meet on a regular basis. Also, when we're creating new therapeutics, we, to the greatest extent possible, are trying to see how they can be open sourced or how there can be versions of them created. Like, the idea that we're only going to create therapeutics for a small portion of the world is ridiculous to begin with. It's crazy that you just wouldn't share the technology for life-saving interventions with other countries because you will stop yourself from getting sick for a while the virus will continue to spread because you couldn't share your technology. So open sharing of technology development is another thing that we are huge on as we move forward in this situation.
But a little less sharing of the virus, preferably.
Yeah, exactly. Not exactly. Not sharing the virus, but basically sharing everything else. Knowledge, yeah. Understanding, mechanisms, drug formulations, anything. Everything else.
It was a really wide-ranging, interesting chat. What a powerhouse, though, she is, honestly.
Absolute delight to speak to. And they actually had a symposium last Friday, which I believe is available on their website. And many of the people that we cite in this interview spoke at the PolyBio symposium on long COVID. So do take a listen to that or go back and find previous episodes where we've spoken to Michael Peluse, Stephen Deeks, the team at UCSF, Akiko, David Pacino, all of these people. There's a lot of information out there, and it's pretty remarkable when you understand that PolyBio is now connecting various of these bodies to bring the research together. They're a global collaboration of scientists. And particularly at the end there of the interview where she says it's about sharing. I really like that idea that they're trying to share their knowledge and actually hopefully get a better outcome for everyone rather than just the select few who might be lucky enough to live in the right location or have enough money to deal with their own long COVID. Join us next week as we hear others' experiences of long COVID. Share your stories and questions at tlcsessions.net. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram for the latest updates. And if you found this interesting, please do subscribe.